Welcome to another T-Rex Talk. Today, I'm really happy to have on the show with me my friend, Henry Chan. Or are we not using your real name?
Yeah, that is my real name, my friend. It's a pleasure being on the show.
It's really good to have you. We've had some conversations before in the past. You are a fascinating guy. Those listening may know you through your YouTube channel, Nine Hole Reviews. You are a student of weapon systems. So we're going to be talking about weapon systems, but what else would you like to tell the listeners to introduce yourself to them?
First of all, thank you for having me on the podcast. I mean, it's a show that I've personally been listening to for a while. And from my end, I appreciate you guys putting out information as you do. For us, I guess if you wanted a brief lowdown on what we do on Nine Hole Reviews, my background, although officially I was a U.S. Army Ordnance Officer, prior to that, I think more influentially, I was what you would call a gun nerd. And as I was growing up as a child, I've always been interested in how firearms and weapons influence not only the tide of war, but also geopolitical activities. And so it was interesting that these machines could have such a great influence on things. And so I started being interested in weapon systems as a whole, or rather being aware of weapon systems as a whole, as a young boy in Hong Kong growing up. And this is pre-internet days, so we couldn't just go on to Google there, so we would have to go to the library. And so I would very frequently be found in the library reading up on different firearms. And I would learn about them in a very firearms-restricted location. So once I came back to America, it was interesting that I started... And coming back to America, I also came back when the internet was really starting to bud with more and more reference websites. This is before YouTube as well. And so I got the calling to serve in the U.S. Army as I was in college, and I did a lot of competitive shooting when I was in college, and so the two sides fed each other, and I was able to basically walk on a farther journey down the road in learning about weapon systems itself.
Yeah, and seeing it from the other side, being an ordnance officer and seeing the actual acquisition and implementation and so forth.
Yeah, it went from initially just going to the library and looking at books with specific rifles in a picture, and afterwards learning about the RFQ process, the trials process, basically how you derive requirements for a certain weapon system and not just the firearm itself.
Yes.
Really opened my eyes on how all of that came together in a picture.
Yeah, I'd love to go down that rabbit trail, but first I got to ask, what are Hong Kong libraries like? At the time that you were there, are they predominantly Cantonese books? Are there a lot of British publications that are there?
So back then it was... So it's interesting because Hong Kong is one of the most regulated, firearms-wise, it's one of the most regulated locations in the world. You're talking about a former British colony, so there's the UK influence, but then also the culture, the Chinese culture has never really been a civil weapons ownership type of culture out there. So there wasn't a background... lineage, heritage of shooting growing up at all. Rather, there was in rural areas. Obviously, China came out with gunpowder, and your farmers could very well make their own shotguns. Very like many people in America would do in rural areas, or not. But in large, in the very urban populous concentrated areas, you just didn't have that culture, right? So your books typically were in Chinese and English. And I remember initially getting into it, both in the Chinese and English section, but actually more so in the English section, because I found more books in English about firearms back then. But there are some in Chinese as well. And so the interesting thing is also learning about the different parts of the firearm in the different languages as well. Because so I learned French after this, but I never read any French books on firearms. So I realized when I was working with the French army, I could not describe what rifling in a barrel was. I had a hard time talking about simple mechanisms on a firearm in French or even in German, because I simply did not learn those words. But I did in Chinese and English. And so it's a mix. It's a mix between the two. But this was, again, the colonial days and then the early post-colonial days of Hong Kong. So I'm not sure if the libraries have changed or really, you know, with the digital age, if all of that has changed either.
If I'm getting the timing right, about the same time that you left Hong Kong, our family moved to New Zealand. And New Zealand is another British colonial destination. Excuse me. And the libraries there, I had similar interests and was reading books on guns and military history with my brother David. And we found a whole bunch of British publishing houses that published firearms and military history books, you know, with a slightly different focus than the American books that we'd seen in our library. So that was a very interesting thing to just get kind of a different perspective on World War II or some of the preceding conflicts, more from a British British viewpoint. Excuse me. And specifically as it relates to weapons, a focus on very different weapon systems, or sometimes even different fighting, different theaters. So the Falklands War was not something that I understood at all. Once we got to New Zealand, there were, you know, books on the Falklands War, more books on the Falklands War than Vietnam, for example.
So interesting on that note, with when you're talking about the former colonies, the former British colonies, or shall I say Commonwealth destinations, there is a difference between Hong Kong and New Zealand with the correlation of World War II, though, because the Japanese did actually take over Hong Kong, and there was a siege of Hong Kong.
Absolutely,
and
yes.
So here's an interesting, because you guys actually talked about airsoft on the T-Rex Arms channel, and in Hong Kong there's a big airsoft scene, and I remember back in the day, when you went out to do little airsoft skirmishes, it very well could be an actual old World War II site.
Oh,
so there was there are actual battlegrounds in Hong Kong where there were engagements, pretty bloody engagements that happened that you could visit and see bullet holes and see where flak cannons were bolted down. And so because of that, you also had the museum element of Hong Kong that had a lot of the firearms that were displayed, and not just firearms, a lot of the equipment that was displayed from engagements back in the day in World War II and prior and after.
And that was another thing that, even though New Zealand was not ever, there was never fighting on New Zealand soil, because the British... and not just British, but other European powers like the Dutch, for example, had a number of colonies that they lost to the Japanese before America got into the war. I learned an awful lot more about the Pacific theater once we were living in New Zealand, and, you know, not just in that part of the world, but again, the focus of some of the history books, the focus or even the memories of people that I met. I met old Dutch men who had been living in Dutch colonies when they were taken over by the Japanese and had lived in concentration camps and been liberated by British or American soldiers. So many things that when I had studied the Pacific theater of World War II, it was entirely from the American side. And in my opinion, you know, everything starts Pearl Harbor, everything ends at the specific time that we dropped the bombs. And I kind of had missed out on everything coming up before, everything leading towards towards that event. So much stuff had happened geopolitically in that part of the world.
Yeah, so that's, I think that's a lot of history that really influences someone wanting to learn about how weapon systems or firearms influence a course of that type of geopolitical activity. I'd say Europe is a very similar boat. I mean, there's been wars touching off in Europe on and off every few decades, as is Asia. But in North America, we're just in this strange bubble to where, when's the last major war, the Civil War that happened in North America? And there's been a lot of change since then on firearms. So really, you couldn't visit any battlegrounds that the firearms that would be relative to the current scene has changed the course of war. But rather, we have expeditionary military actions to where veterans would come back and talk about these weapon systems and generate, you know, whether it's pop culture, books, movies, video games, that then influence the individual's interest in it.
I think that's a good point. We were talking about that a little bit with the Redbeard tactical guys that came over. We were looking at maps of the United States and talking about, you know, different defensive features or different, not even combat necessarily, but just these are the types of terrain and these are the types of climate that you would deal with if you were operating or even just hiking in these areas, and just thinking about the fact that, yeah, there hasn't been any combat in any of these places for over 150 years. And so much has changed since then that a lot of the lessons about the terrain or the climate would hold true, but the way that you would go about doing those types of military action, even the really cutting edge hit and run guerrilla type warfare that was being trialed by some pretty advanced thinkers in cavalry units in the Confederacy. Like, that was very advanced thinking at the time, still nothing like you would see today. And so that's the one reason that I think it is so fascinating for us to look at footage from Ukraine right now, because that looks like home for a lot of us in terms of the terrain and the urban, just what the urban landscape looks like, where the fighting is happening. The weapons that are there are very similar to the weapons that people would be fighting with in the West. And so I think that that has been a really fascinating series of thought experiments for people as they look at footage from Ukraine and they think about what things would look like in a much larger near peer conflict in modern times in not Afghanistan.
Right, yeah. And the civil firearms ownership has a big role in when it comes to looking at historical examples like this. So if you're looking at Asia, where firearms are highly restricted, it would be really interesting, because if you're talking about what kind of ammunition you would want to supply a local insurgency, well, it would be what the local occupying force would be using. Whereas if you're talking about even Ukraine with the litany of legacy weapons from World War II, with the, you know, a much smaller percentage civil firearms ownership, but with the civil firearms ownership that's seen in Ukraine, I mean, people are digging up Thompson submachine guns from, again, these are American Thompsons from World War II that were given with a Lend-Lease program. How are you going to find 45 ACP in Ukraine? Right?
Yes.
But I mean, I guess that's kind of got a segue back into the initial topic that we were talking about, the weapon system.
It's true. We're having a wide-ranging conversation and chasing all the rabbit holes. But this idea of a weapon system, not just a weapon, I think is very important, because I know I certainly in the past have thought about a weapon system as being the weapon and not the entire supply chain of keeping that maintained. At T-Rex, we have begun to think of the holster as part of the weapon system for a fighting handgun, for example. But there's a lot of pieces there, and I really appreciate what you have done as you talk about certain platforms on Nine Hole Reviews at digging deeper. I actually really loved the video on the the PDW ammo trials that were done by NATO, because I had always thought, like most people, that they were actually testing the weapons themselves. But no, this was just purely ammunition trials.
Right. Yeah. So if we were to look at weapon systems, right, one of the videos that we worked on was defining the weapon system itself, which you're looking at a sighting system, the ammunition, and of course the base firearm. And I think a lot of times if you were to jump back and think, well, you know, why didn't we call them weapon systems back in World War II? Well, they were weapon systems. The sights were always integral to the firearm because optics back then were not a very prevalent thing. And you can get some pretty decent mechanical accuracy out of mechanical sighting systems. Unfortunately, nowadays, people sort of don't practice with mechanical sighting systems. I understand why. It's just not as prevalent these days, and most of them are backups. But I digress. I mean, back then, it was still a weapon system. You still had ammunition choice. The Garand was not initially designed to take the 30-06, the M2 ball. It was designed for a 270 caliber. But because of the abundance of 30 caliber M2 ball in the U.S. arsenal, the U.S. asked John Garand to redesign the firearm to take the M2 ball. Now, is that optimal to the system? I mean, that's from an individual private citizen, you may argue, well, you know, ballistic coefficient is probably better with a more slender and sleek projectile. But at the end of the day, if you're looking from an ordnance perspective, if we have, you know, 50 million rounds of M2 ball for the U.S. military and we need to mobilize 2 years ago,
yeah,
you're probably going to have a better chance in getting everyone supplied with the ammunition that you had by altering the specs on the firearm to, you know, change the sights to match M2 ball and change the barrel to match M2 ball and change the gas port. I mean, that's probably going to be a much easier solution to that weapon system itself.
Yeah. It's going to give you a more capable fighting force, even if it is technically a less capable round.
Correct. Yeah, just by virtue of having it. And I think to your point earlier when we were talking, we're seeing a lot of this in Ukraine right now in the sense that when you look at the artillery pieces that they have, they had a lot of artillery pieces, and we had pushed a lot of the former Soviet 152-millimeter shells over to the Ukrainians to send, whether they're using their D-10s or whatever systems they have to shoot. But now that they've exhausted a lot of those, and we don't have as much in the Western side to supply, that causes an issue, because even if you have the guns, the field guns with barrels that are still serviceable, the field guns are still in good condition. If you don't have ample amount of ammunition to go around, it's basically useless. So also to your point, when we're talking about the NATO PDW trials, why ammunition was such a huge focus for that. It wasn't just ammunition performance, but also, you know, a litany of items to it.
Yeah. And obviously military trials can be tainted by political goals and meddling. But thinking about weapon systems in such a larger way is, I think, something that militaries have done a better job of than individuals a lot of the time. And I can think, especially just for my own case, in the past, I have thought very selfishly about certain choices of firearm or customization of firearms to the point where I don't think it was necessarily wrong. But as carry has become more common and more prevalent, I actually see value in having a less customized firearm. And there have been times when I have traveled and being able to use a non-customized Glock, for example, because that is something that has been available to me to borrow in a country where I couldn't bring my own. You know, if I were going to the Olympics, I would get a weapon absolutely customized to me, and I'd probably make two, so I'd have a backup. But this idea of uniform equipment adoption so that existing supply chains can be taken advantage of, so that training has a force multiplier attached to it because of the economies of scale. I had never really thought about all of that stuff until probably 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, when we get into firearms as hobbyists or as enthusiasts, we start thinking about, you know, which one design is the king of them all. I just want one general purpose firearm that rules all of them, can do everything. But really, if you're thinking about it, it's all requirement driven, right? But at the end of the day, if you're also thinking about this from a logistics perspective, and you're putting the factor of training into it, which training is a big factor into weapons proficiency and, well, any proficiency. Let's say you go to Europe tomorrow and you've got the most souped up, most amazing Ferrari at home, and you're smoking everyone on the tracks with it, and you go to Europe and you have to get a fast car. Well, there's only standard transmissions available, and you can't drive standard transmissions. I mean, that sort of happens in some places. There are some police departments that will not issue red dot sights. I think is it California that doesn't allow electronic sighting systems?
It sounds like California. It also sounds like New York potentially.
Yeah, or in my case, when I was a late deployer to my Afghanistan deployment, and so they signed out all of the M4s, and they only had two options for me at that point. It was either a 249.
Okay.
Or an M16A2. Neither of them had electronic sights on them. Everything was just signed out. Or the company commander wasn't signing out extras. So at that point, I took the A2, but I was also very familiar and very comfortable with it because I'd shot civilian matches with A2 in the past. So are iron sights better than red? That type of question really...
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's more of a question of what's more available and what are your chances of running into which item. And so should you have exposure to either?
My thinking on having a bigger picture, wider view has only expanded as I've been working directly with T-Rex and working directly with what weapons we make holsters for and what gear do we develop and what does it need to support? And are we going to go with brand new, esoteric, untested equipment, or are we going to do fairly basic, understandable stuff? Are we going to stick with Molly, or are we going to do some brand new thing that nobody else is going to have? And we really have leaned more towards industry standard stuff so that there can be greater standardization and our gear is more useful with less training and our gear is more useful for people to just hand out. And we see a lot of experimental stuff, partly because we want to stay on top of it. But a lot of times people that come to, say, the T-Rex range have brought something weird, and sometimes people will buy weird stuff and then they're at the range and they'll ask me, like, hey, how do I set this up? It's like, well, I have no idea. I've never seen one of those before. I'm like, yeah, but you're a gear expert. It's like, yeah, but I don't know what that is. so the idea of standardization used to bug me because it felt like by standardizing too much, you are limiting the possibility for innovation and having the better solution that a small minority will have picked because they're smarter than the majority. But you actually, like with the M1 Garand, you actually miss out on some larger, bigger advantages if you focus entirely on one of the many factors that you should be looking at.
Well, yeah, I think you hit on a good point there. And I think, you know, modularity has become a big buzzword these days, so much so that people sort of gloss over it and don't really give it a second thought and what that actually means, right? So when it comes to, let's say, Molly standard webbing, or let's talk about M-Lock as the new standard for rail attachments instead of key mod. If you're talking about Picatinny 1913 rail interface systems, I mean, all of those are very, very, very powerful concepts of being able to integrate multiple different types of pieces into what makes a weapon system. Because at that point, let's say slings. You guys make slings. What does a sling do? A sling gives you an extra capability. What is that capability? You can use your hands to do things around you. Crazy for people to think that you're, as a soldier, you're not holding on to your weapon and not having to do other things 99% of the time.
Yeah.
Because you are.
And if something happens to you, yeah, like if a guy hits you on the head with a skateboard and you fall down, you still have your rifle.
Right. It's a
major force multiplier.
And it's been around since forever. But these are the things that make up a weapon system that give you that extra capability, right? A lot of this is also requirement driven. Let's say in a three-gun match. I know Josh, my co-host, is a grandmaster with USPSA. They don't shoot with slings on because it actually gets in their way. A lot of them don't shoot with backup iron sights. Because if your sighting system goes down in a match, you could actually just QD a different sight on there instead of having to flip up. But if you're in the middle of Ukraine and you lost your sling and you lost your sights, that's a slightly bigger problem than someone shooting for Grandmaster at a USPSA match.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But with the concept of modularity, right, we're looking at the US military really amping up a lot of these further developments. We talked about the P320 or the M17 pistol. I think that is one of the next levels, because we're then, instead of looking at just a lower that has to be machined, you're looking at a trigger pack that is the chassis that drops into a polymer grip, and that turns into the firearm. And then you have guys coming up with the Flux Raider for...
Oh, yes, yeah. It opens up all kinds of innovative possibilities, and I know we've talked in the past about 3D printing, like the ability to carry the absolute bare essentials, only the stuff that's the hardest to make into the field. And then in the field, you have your 3D printers and you print whatever it is that you need to make up the remainder of the parts as you need them.
Right. Yeah. So that's additive manufacturing is the next step in military logistics, in my opinion. I mean, it's similar to, let's say, if you're trying to colonize the moon. I'm fairly certain 3D printing is going to be an integral part of space travel, because instead of bringing a million different types of widgets, you can 3D print it. So imagine, you remember the Apollo 13 movie?
Yeah, they had this very complicated system where they had all the individual parts, but the system as a whole didn't function. They had pieces from the lunar lander that they could use. They had tanks of raw oxygen that they could access, but they had to build their own carbon dioxide scrubbers and set up fans and hoses and things to do it inside of their tiny, tiny spacecraft.
Right. So imagine if that spacecraft had 3D printing technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were able to just print the chassis that would house the oxygen or the CO2 scrubber, and they could then quickly deploy that as something that they could breathe CO2 with. A similar concept if you're running an expeditionary army, instead of bringing all those random pieces and parts, instead of Joe Snuffy in the motor pool trying to rig up some type of a sandbag contraption this is in reference to early GWAT eras when the Marines and the Army crossing into Iraq were putting sandbags on the floor as extra protection against IEDs or anything like that. You're able to have someone over at Big DOD come up with a program or come up with the STL files to then spit out the item that you need that you could then use to... basically in the field, generate parts for your item for upgrades. The same thing for weapon systems. Imagine if you had a P320 and in the field, you all of a sudden had a diplomatic protection mission that came down. And then you yank out the P320 chassis, you quickly had your supply the 4 is what we call them, the S4, print out all new brand new chassis that have stocks on them, and you convert your existing pistols into submachine guns or PDWs for immediate use. I mean, that type of technology is in my opinion going to be next level in pushing military logistics, because all you would bring up to the front were it would eliminate a lot of parts that you would have to bring to the front, and all you would have would be 3D printing machines and filament.
This levels the playing field in a lot of ways, because now what you have is you could have really small military units or small nations, and this increased flexibility of their logistics allows them to be more agile and to compete where they're able to radically redesign or reallocate resources to deal with threats. Whereas the only people who have been able to do that in the past have been nations that are large enough where they bring enough sidearms for everybody and enough submachine guns for everybody and enough spare parts for both. Like, now the little guy actually has the ability to compete across a number of domains with fewer resources and fewer people. So I think that it is something that is going to disproportionately or at least equally improve the little guy's capabilities as well as the, you know, the superpowers.
It's firepower through superior logistics. It's the name of the game.
Yes. And it's the sort of thing that benefits little companies as well. Like, we're using 3D printing for rapid prototyping and trying to be very agile, bring things to market very quickly. And improved additive manufacturing is going to take things that used to be achievable only in a very large factory. And now you can bring those back to where those parts can now be made in a small shop. You can bring manufacturing back to a small town. A lot of stuff that left individual family economies and went to giant factory towns actually has the potential to come back to cottage industry and individual households even, potentially.
Right. And I mean, imagine this. When you're talking about additive manufacturing technology, you're not just talking about polymers. You're talking about metals as well. I mean, we have suppressors, OSS or Huxworks. They've been doing those additive flow through suppressors, and I think they just released that one that won the FBI contract. We've got one that we're about to trial on our end, but
okay. Well, I'll look forward to that review.
Yeah, but the
if you're going to talk about it,
I will. I mean, I haven't gotten to shoot any out of the new one because it's still waiting for the papers.
Of course.
But, but the pre-3D printed version actually works quite well. But if you're talking about the metal printing too, I mean, you're talking about a device that then could contain quite a bit of pressure. A device that you could have internal lattice that you could not have manufactured prior to this with traditional milling or forgings. I mean, the concept of where it could go, it could be endless at that point.
And hopefully it's the sort of thing that is widely adopted and then widely experimented with. One thing that I am a little bit worried about is when there's too much institutional inertia. So right now there's a lot of expectation that the way that we deal with energy issues is we go completely to renewables, solar, green stuff, etc. It could be that if you could 3D print an engine block, you could 3D print an engine block with some of these internal lattices that is so efficient that it actually is worth working on. And if people... hopefully people have the intellectual freedom to actually be thinking about these issues and continue to pursue stuff that has been declared not by the free market or by actual science, but have been declared politically a scientific dead end. Hopefully people continue to explore those theoretical dead ends, because I think there's actually a long road left to go on a whole bunch of different technologies that are unpopular today.
on the note of basically just 3D printing things, you know, one thing, and you may have a better idea on this than I do. So if you wear something out 3D printed, is there any type of technology or actually a concept behind it to where you would then take it, either break it down, melt it, or whatever, and reuse it?
I believe so. I think that there are a few materials that I can think of where if you have heat treated them, you've changed the crystalline structure of the actual material. But in most cases, with PLA and ABS and some of the most basic ones, if you grind up your 3D model, melt it down, and re-extrude it, you get filament that you are just ready to print with again. And if it's something that's been, you know, used outside in the dirt and the mud, you would have to clean it before you do that, or you'd have to, you know, as you melt it down, scrape the stuff off the top. There'd be a little bit of hassle involved in making sure that the filament that comes out is clean and pure and really, really reliable, but absolutely.
So the reason I bring that up is if we're looking at the model of an expeditionary military, imagine if you then took worn down items and you were able to replace them with newly 3D printed items and then take the old ones, melt it back down into usable material, and then you significantly decrease the amount of materiel that you need to push across a potentially really long network supply chain.
Yes. This also helps in defensive. I mean, we keep talking about expeditionary situations, but it also helps for defensive forces as well. One of the things, going back to the American Civil War, one of the things that really sunk the Confederate States was the blockade. They could not get material that they needed. They couldn't get the support that they needed. If they had been able to do more internally, they could have lasted longer. And so the ability to do more with what you have and recycle what you have is something that is really, really useful for a defensive group of people who are stuck, trapped, besieged, whatever.
Yeah, I think the opportunities for 3D is endless as we're looking at it right now. And I do think at some point, you know that one scene in Aliens where they were serving food and all they did, they just had this mush that came out?
Well, yes. The recycled food is something that eventually comes out.
I wonder if it's going to get to that point, because that still is a line item for military forces. But then if you look at that technology and you apply it for people in America who are, you know, prepping.
This is an area where I feel like the defensive forces have a significant leg up, because all the research that I've seen on manufactured foods, there is nothing more efficient to manufacture food than actual animals. So having some chickens that turn bugs into eggs, way better than eating the bugs or rendering them down into something else with a chemical digester. So sometimes the old fashioned ways are the most energy efficient and smallest.
Look, Isaac, you don't have to convince me to eat eggs, like real chicken eggs, rather than this. Let's just call it recycled food, because I don't want to mince into how you make sausage that way.
There's an animal that makes sausage really well out of acorns. And I would so much rather eat bacon than acorns.
Well, okay. So if we were to shift back to the weapon systems.
Yeah, but getting back to weapon systems, as you have studied different things, PDWs in particular, you've looked at in good depth, and you're currently doing some stuff with designated marksman rifles and sniper rifles. You've published some videos on 22 pistols and their use, not just in assassinations, which is the obvious role that those fill, but also in counterterror. That was a fascinating video. What are some of the most interesting lessons that you've learned, or most unexpected and surprising takeaways?
I think if we were to look back at the procurement system for the U.S. military, it's interesting how a firearm goes from nothing into something that is widespread in the U.S. military. For instance, right, you're looking at the prolific use of red dots on firearms. Well, a lot of those red dots initially came from the sporting community, and a lot of those sporting community red dots were observed by special forces or SOCOM operators and being adopted in. But prior to that, I mean, a lot of people were busting them for saying it's too bulky, it's not rugged enough, this is some civilian junk. But in a certain way, these interesting concepts, if you are to continually poke at it and say that they have no legs and you don't experiment with them, of course they're not going to go anywhere. But that is has been one of the strengths of, in the last few decades, of the American, the U.S. military and how they procure. They listen to the special forces guys who actually look at whether it's sporting or whether it's foreign militaries and what they do. And you learn things through cross-training. You learn things through observing what civilians are doing, and you try to militarize something and ruggedize something and seeing if there's legs. And if there are legs for said concept, then you push it out. Same, that's actually drawing back to the modular system. That's how the modular system came about, is because SF guys wanted to mount accessories onto weapons. So before, people would probably say, well, why are you mounting this giant light onto the top of an MP5? That's stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's an actual use for it. And that come down multiple years. Now you see most U.S. military firearms, if they're going overseas, in the hands of an 11 Bravo, they will have a weapons mounted light, because there's actual utilitarian use for it. So when we're looking at concepts like the PDW, we're looking at concepts like using 22 in a non-traditional way. We have guys that train with the Israelis who saw them use 22s in their operations. The 22s that they used, obviously, you have a very lacking terminal effect on the target, but they have to compensate then with a massive amount of rounds that they dump into the target. And if you look at the classic telltale signs of an Israeli hit back then, it was just a massive amount of 22 projectiles stuck into someone. And you would be able to tell, oh, I see. this smells very Israeli.
Mossad has been here. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of times I think when it comes down to looking back at concepts that may have died for a certain period, it may have died in a certain circumstance because it just wasn't mature yet for that time frame. Whereas right now we may have different developments in powder, ammunition, or whatever. And so you could make a weapon system a lot smaller. You could have it shoot a higher velocity projectile. We were talking about flow-through suppressors. You know, now with a flow-through suppressor, if you even make it a lot smaller, you could potentially shoot, you could potentially outfit a lot more firearms with suppressors, which back in the day would cause issues with a gas system, which is what they're doing. They're outfitting a lot more rifles with suppressors. So it's a dangerous notion, not just with firearms, but with many things in general in life, that you just automatically shut down ideas before you see if they could grow legs and run.
We could probably think of a lot of examples, things like the M16 on its initial rollout with the wrong magazines, the wrong ammunition, and lack of cleaning kits was not as reliable as when it eventually got the right ammunition and the proper magazines and actual maintenance schedules. And that's obviously a platform that has benefited from a lot of different improvements over the last six decades. But yeah, there's a bunch of things that I would love to try again based on some new developments and based on some new materials. So fixed barrel handguns are very rare because the Browning tilt barrel system is superior. It's just a superior action, unless you want a suppressor mounted on that fixed barrel and you want a non-reciprocating slide for a red dot, stuff that wasn't being considered at all back when people transitioned almost exclusively to the tilt barrel recoil system. So there are some things, even old-fashioned things, that are worth trying again based on new criteria or new opportunities or new materials, I think all the time.
More so new manufacturing techniques.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent point.
So if we were to once again dive back to the 3D printing side, just pull the lock system for a 320, drop it into a new 3D printed prototype with a fixed barrel and a different operating system with a PDW that has a stock, and you could very well have something that looks entirely different from what a 320 is, but at the core of it is still that nucleus. It's still a 320 in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
SIG P320. I realize I've been throwing a lot of words around, but for people out there wondering, the SIG P320 is a new handgun that the U.S. military adopted, but the serialized part is really just the middle of it. So the entire grip that wraps around it is non-serialized. So you can swap out any of the grips, any of the slides, anything, and generate a million different, well, not a million, but a varied amount of different variations out there.
Oh, SIG is going to come up with a million different variants on their own. They're going to have weird names, like they're going to have a Spartan and a Legion and a Scorpion, and we're going to have to make a new holster for each one because each one's going to be just a hair different. XL, X5, X-Carry, X-Fold, they're all going to be...
Well, the interesting thing is going to be initially right now, I think, on the civil side. You know, what are American civilians going to adopt to it, especially with the proliferation of people 3D printing their own accessories nowadays, right? How that could adopt to certain technologies like a chassis-based system. I think you and I talked about this in the past. Or no, you talked about this with Matt over at Fudbusters.
Yeah, the lock and the tricky part of the gun is the only part that you have to pay extra for.
And back in the day, during the pre-Revolutionary War days, that's what they imported to America. Not the entire firearm, not the stocks, because they could just whittle a piece of a tree and create their own stocks. Not even the barrel, because they needed it to fit their local shot, but the locks itself. And so this, very interestingly, is a throwback to something that early day Americans were doing in the 1700s.
It's fun to see some tried and true ideas coming back with new technologies, new materials. Yeah, those new manufacturing technologies are huge. One of the things that's interesting to me is if you compare the AK-47 platform to the AR-15 platform. One of the issues with the AR-15, well, all the AR platforms in the 1960s was this very precise milling, machining of aluminum was very expensive compared to stamped steel receivers for the AK-47, because Soviet Union had tons of these gigantic stamping factories. But today, that has completely changed. There aren't that many people running these gigantic steel stamping factories. And CNC machines have been democratized so that I'm trying to think how many serious vertical milling centers we have in the industrial park where T-Rex is. I think we have a dozen CNC machines that could make AR-15 lowers with almost, we'd have to make some tooling, but just the sheer number of machines that are available to make what used to be the hardest part of the gun has completely changed the AK-47 from being the people's rifle that is available everywhere. The only people that can't own it are the people in the Soviet Union, ironically enough. But now the AR-15 is more like the people's rifle because any free people can make it.
It's hard to ban knowledge. I mean, when I was a boy, I was learning about different weapon systems from the public library. And nowadays, you're talking about the internet to where, I mean, let's be real, the amount of STL files on 3D printed firearms is unimaginable at this point.
Yes. I can't tell you how I know, but I do know this, yes.
You basically, at this point, the world has generated this knowledge sharing machine called the internet. And so the other side would be the manufacturing machines, whether it's a CNC machine or a 3D printer.
Well, at the end of the day, gun control is kind of a futile pursuit if you don't have total control. If you don't have control over tools, knowledge, mm-hmm. if you don't have really total control over people,
right?
You can't have gun control.
I think that's an interesting point to look at when you're talking about, you know, whether it's total control, because I know you just did a podcast on totalitarianism and the value of total control that lends to a totalitarian control of a people or a government or whatever. Let's say historically, I'm ethnically, I'm Chinese. I grew up over in Hong Kong. I grew up in the culture. My family, you know, we're Southern Chinese. Historically, Chinese emperors at one point could even control the ownership of knives and kitchen knives. You would have phenomenons where the one village had one knife.
Chained to a stump or chained to an iron post and guarded by the soldiers.
Right. And yet you would still, at the end of it, as time went on, you would still have rebellion and the overthrow of said dynasty.
Yes. Legend has it that's where martial arts and unarmed combat was developed, in some of these disarmed villages.
Is that true?
I don't know. This is the thing. My knowledge of martial arts is pretty limited to Jackie Chan movies. So I wouldn't know for sure. But this is the legend that I've been told, is that disarmed Chinese populations developed martial arts around the few tools that they were allowed, rice flails, rice planting tools, things like this. And then, of course, the unarmed different disciplines, because they had no other options.
So if we're talking about a concept of gun control, right, and you're talking about a weapon system requiring a sight system, the base platform, and ammunition in order to be an effective weapon system. One of the elements that has been thrown around is also about the controlling the ammunition, because right now we are still using a very old cartridge concept that has been around for 100 plus years. But I find it interesting when people now are looking at electronically fired projectiles. I think Ian over at Forgotten Weapons showed off the one of the first commercially available Gauss rifles.
Yes, the Arc Flash guys are doing some interesting stuff.
Now, imagine if that technology matures, and right now it's still unregulated because it is not a firearm. There is no flame, per se. And so imagine if that technology matures and you're able to take advantage of further development in battery technology, in capacitor technology. You're able to take advantage of newer manufacturing techniques instead of just printing the lattice, the framework of the firearm. If you're able to inlay certain electrical components into that firearm, I mean, what would that bring about? At that point, I'm not sure if there would be any merit to regulate just the projectile, because you could make those to fire anything, kind of like a blunderbuss.
We in America have not only been spoiled, I think, by our tremendous access to weapons technology. With all the restrictions that we do have, there's so much more freedom than other parts of the world. But our conversation about gun control is so significantly limited to the guns that exist and firearms and specifically types of firearms that existed in 1934, for example. Yeah, the conversation that revolves around gun control today has to expand to revolve around manufacturing technology and information sharing technology in the future, because eventually firearms will not be devices that shoot 5.56 cartridge ammunition. Weapons will advance beyond that, or at the very least get outside of those categories.
Yeah. I mean, the other side of the weapon system, and this is veering away from the weapon system itself, but drives the development of the weapon system, is the often phrase, you develop the spear and then you develop the shield. And it's a never-ending cycle. So when you're talking also about protection, your body armor development, you're then also talking about a further development of the weapon systems itself. The XM5 is the prime example that we're thinking about right now. But then also that gives us that's a whole different can of worms to really delve into if we're looking at the XM5 weapon system.
Yeah.
Because it's super heavy.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's super heavy, right?
Yes.
And then, I mean, what if at that point, so you've got these 20 rounds of pocket rockets that you could slam out to 800 meters, right? Great. So now what if the enemy decides, yeah, I'm just going to dump my body armor because you're going to shoot through it anyways, and we're going to Viet Cong you and do 20-meter ambushes in urban environments.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, what then? You've eliminated your firepower that you have on hand. You carry less ammunition because it's heavier. But at the same time, I'm not trying to act like the XM5 is going to be a general issue item. Regardless, I can't foresee the future of what will happen with the weapon system. But some of these issues may not just be driven by the performance of the firearm itself, but also the protection technology, the body armor technology that's out there.
This is a conversation that my brother David would be well suited to. He has spent the most time studying body armor. And it is interesting that just in the last few decades, we have really seen body armor be, what's the right word, but basically extremely useful in a way that it hasn't been since probably the English Civil War, matchlock times. It's taken a long time and I'm talking, of course, about personal armor. Obviously, there have been armored vehicles that are able to carry around significant defensive armor. But for the foot soldier, we have body armor that can defeat rifle projectiles in a way that hasn't really been true for the 20th century, most of the 20th century, most of the 19th century. It's been a while since people carrying body armor, the performance has been worth the weight. It took a little while for the material technology of the armor to catch up to the military, just the terminal capabilities of the projectile.
Yeah, so that's the next step for what we're looking at right now. If you've developed a better shield, now what's going to happen to the spear? Ha! Mm-hmm. You get what I see? What I did there?
Absolutely.
The XM5, the spear.
Absolutely, it's very nice. Yeah.
So I think if we were to really draw things back down, in the past, a lot of times when we were growing up, well, I was growing up in the 80s and the 90s, we would still look at a weapon system as just the firearm itself because of the limitations of manufacturing technology, optic availability, or anything. A lot of people were still using iron sights that were built into the rifle and non-interchangeable with anything else and firing a standardized ammunition under the Warsaw Pact or NATO. And so when you have those items of the weapon system locked down and there's no modularity, it's easy to fall back and think of an entire weapon system is just the firearm itself. But nowadays, with the new technology, with the new interface systems, and with the new development of peripheral items like body armor, we've expanded that concept of a weapon system. You have electronic aiming devices, you have other night vision devices, you have weapon-mounted lights, lasers, you have different types of stocks for different applications, different triggers, or even just 3D printed whatevers that you could put onto the firearm itself to accomplish your specific needs for whatever requirement you're looking at. And a lot of that has been very military-driven for the express logistical need of an unlimited package for unlimited capabilities for the soldier in the front.
Do you see that changing? Because I see a lot of innovation in the civilian space. Obviously, that's where I live. Do you see more experimental, innovative stuff happening on the civilian side now, where there are just so many more people now who are in gun culture 3.0 mode, have their own 3D printers or tinkering with their own stuff, buying their own night vision, publishing really interesting reports on using different electronic sites with head-mounted night vision, et cetera?
Well, yeah, the internet's changed a lot of that, hasn't it? And not just the internet, but your manufacturing techniques, your 3D printers, your just the entire... We've taken what used to have to rely on a military-industrial complex and push that down to the end user. The most important thing that you have is also the knowledge sharing system out there. I mean, it's silly to think about this, but we get more intel from a YouTube video than probably intel officers in the 70s got on the Soviet Union. And that is insane. That is an insane concept to think about, how much we have pushed the knowledge and the intel out. Now, I think the big struggle we're going to run up with is how to filter this information.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
You can't look at every design and say that's the next best thing. I think the biggest challenge for us, as and not just with weapon platforms, but you know, just even with personal development, or you have children, teaching your kids, is to how to decipher this massive amount of information that's coming in, because the power and the knowledge is in your hands at this point.
The information has outstripped the discernment at this point. And in some ways, we see that in funny ways, like when Mike Grantham published his video on recce rifles. It was the next fad, and everybody had a recce rifle that was designed around no specific recce mission. But I do think that it is wonderful that, you know, the information is there and the discernment can now rise to meet it as people really think about these things and find, you know, people like yourself who are wanting to work with the information that's available and learn the lessons from history. I think that's huge. I really appreciate what you're doing with Nine Hole Reviews. I feel like you and Ian McCollum are really... kind of doing two sides of the same coin in some ways. So he will look at a weapon and talk about it from an engineering perspective. And I'm kind of an engineer, sort of. And so I really appreciate that. But then you will look at that weapon and think about it as a system and talk about it in its history and how it was actually implemented as a weapon on a battlefield that changed the course of human history. Or a weapon on a battlefield that may change the course of human history in the future. And so I really see both of you as doing a fascinating job that hopefully charges people's discernment capability as they look at all the new information that's constantly coming out of YouTubers with guns on flat ranges or YouTubers analyzing videos coming out of Ukraine.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, you left out the manufacturing side, which is what you're doing. And I think even though right now that we're talking about a proliferation of 3D printers and manufacturing items that you could do at home, it's not there yet. Is it under development? Yes. Is it going very, very fast, much faster than we think? Absolutely, yes. But is it there yet? Do we still need collective organizations like you guys to sort of tinker around with things, to have the resources and have the time? And I mean, it's silly to think about this, but being able to free yourself from a regular 9-to-5 instead of sitting in a cubicle to where you, Isaac, could sit around in front of a 3D printer and a computer and print out useful, interesting things without having the pressure of feeding your family otherwise. I mean, those are all interesting points of the interesting sides of the same coin. And what we're seeing right now is every single aspect of this being pushed down to the civilian side, whether it was intended or not. Mm-hmm. I tend to think that it was not intended. And right now, I think a lot of governments around the world are freaking out how much of the previous controlled knowledge has gone out to the public. And so it's interesting times that we're living in right now, for sure. Oh,
absolutely. And I am really grateful to be around to see it. But I'm also really grateful at the interest that so many people have shown. Obviously, T-Rex's growth as a company is because of them. But it isn't just T-Rex. I am so gratified to see the interest in some of these tools and techniques and technologies growing to the point where there's a whole bunch of companies making very interesting, cool, new experimental stuff. And the interest that exists in this field is such that lots of little companies have sprung up. Lots of people have left their 9-to-5 jobs to work on solving these problems or meeting certain needs and tinkering and experimenting with new, oftentimes little bits and pieces. There's 100 Concepts is, I believe, the name. They came up with some little 3D printed gadgets that are super cool. And there's nothing complicated about them. And if you had a 3D printer, you could totally make your own. But they have some load lifters that go onto backpacks and other types of straps that just hold your rifle sling out of the way. Genius, I mean, ingenious stuff. Little caps that cover your weapon lights during the day to stop flash and protect the glass. And you can flip them out of the way with retained rubber bands. Like, very simple stuff that you could probably make with stuff you find in your kitchen. Or you could buy these things, pay for them to work on the next generation of stuff, the next ideas that they have, and grow their own company. And I see so much of that entrepreneurship happening in this space because of the interest that exists. And obviously, I'm personally grateful for the opportunity to grow T-Rex, but I am so encouraged by the growth outside of T-Rex, the rising tide that's lifting so many other ships and causing people to think about things that are not only cool, but potentially have tremendous value for the economy, bringing more manufacturing capable people into this space. But also, these are, when we talk about weapons and weapon systems, these are things that force you to confront other responsibilities, and I think are really good for a population at large to really be thinking about the responsibilities that they have and that come with being interested in weapon systems in general.
Yeah, it's going to sound corny and sound like dad advice, but if there's ever a greater time to foster people just generally being good people, it is now, because we have more power on our hands to do evil if we were truly evil. And so I think that's going to be our biggest challenge is, you know, as a whole, how do we foster a culture of do-gooders out there? How do you teach your kids what is right and wrong? There's a lot that's at your fingertips out there on the internet. We had the luxury of sitting in a bubble, isolated away from this bad information in the 80s and the 90s and early 2000s even. But after that, it's been accessible to a lot of younger minds out there. And so that is going to be a continually difficult task in passing on, is you can generate a lot of technology, but at the end of the day, the most difficult thing is to change culture, especially change culture for the greater good, things like that. That is going to be the most difficult thing, especially America as a young country. Without a lot of cultural anchors behind it, that is an exceedingly difficult task, and not impossible, and absolutely takes fortitude, but a difficult task.
Yes, now I think that's very, very well said, and at the end of the day, weapons and even complete weapon systems are only tools, and they can be used for good or evil, just like the internet is a tool. So many of these things that we have at our fingertips are more powerful tools than the ones that existed in the past. And so the responsibility for all of us is it is a lot greater. And so these are exciting times.
Isaac and I, just for viewers out there, Isaac and I will be texting about some crazy thing that we saw or whatever, doing something after dinner when I'm not at work. And I'll text Isaac about something, and it's with the child. And that's when I have the most thought about this type of thing. You know, going to the future, what is my child going to see?
Yes.
What type of world are we putting them into?
Another whole rabbit hole of thought opens up as to all of us have a level of responsibility to that second, or that rather that next generation that is coming along. Whether or not you have children of your own, your ability to impact the world that my kids and Henry's kids are going to grow up in is huge. And so that's a lot to think about.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, at the core of it, the weapon system of itself, like you said, couldn't have said it better, is a tool, and we're humans.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Henry. Is there anything else that you would like to mention or to cover? Anything that you've, any projects coming up that you want to tell people about so that they can be excited for?
We, Josh and I, my co-host and I, we run a channel called Nine Hole Reviews. And up to this date, it has been a very structured look at weapon systems and how they perform. A lot of times at distance, but sometimes also up close, and sometimes as a whole, how they fit into history. But as we expand that, as a big initiative that we have, we wanted to go into the podcast sphere. Much like when you have a rifle, you could sling it on your back and use your hands to do things. 99% of our times, we require our eyes to do things out there. And really, I wanted to delve into more intellectual conversations, or really just thoughts like what we're having today, and put those onto Nine Hole Reviews. Now, whether that's historical or projecting in the future or just personal interest, that's up for the show itself to define. But the podcast scene is something that we're very interested in exploring together with everybody.
Yeah, I would love to continue to chat, you know, in the evenings when the kids are not taking up too much of our time. But obviously, potentially future podcasts. I hope that folks are able to check out some of your content and find it intellectually stimulating. And then, looking forward to that podcast as well. So thank you again, Henry, for coming on. Really appreciate having you. At some point, I want to talk about all the places that you've been in the world. It's not directly related to weapons, but it would be a very long conversation.
It would be fun, for sure.
Check out the links in the show notes for more information about Nine Hole Reviews. And we'll probably be talking about gun control in the next podcast, because there's a bunch of stuff happening in the legislative sphere, but no promises. It might die in the Senate.